Believe that we do have a quorum, but I don't see the members. Okay, if they're having lunch in the back, everybody's here. Okay, good. Good morning. Good afternoon. To start, we're going to go through an overview of the Mental Health Initiative by the Department of Human Services. Welcome. If you could please introduce yourself.
Yes. Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration, fairly recently appointed as the Assistant Commissioner. Background is I am a child and adolescent psychiatrist and an adult psychiatrist and pediatrician. I believe most of you have had an opportunity to meet. I've been asked to give a few words this morning with a little bit of brief background, introducing the background to the previous mental health initiative passed in 2007, prior to some other bills that you'll be hearing later today. So quickly, just to kind of walk us through a very brief presentation, the Governor's Mental Health Initiative was passed in 2007. A tremendous amount of work went into this initiative. Its passing truly demonstrates the need to have significant changes in the mental health system in our state. Although we have accomplished much in Minnesota to improve mental health care for Minnesotans, by no means are we done. After I speak this morning, you'll hear from Glennis Edwall, the director of our Children's Mental Health Division, and from Sharon Audio, the director of our Adult Mental Health Division. They'll provide you current updates on the child and the adult portions of the Mental Health Initiative. I want to take a few minutes to just quickly say who we are and who we serve and how we serve them within the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. So within the Department of Human Services, I am the Assistant Commissioner over CMHS, and we have three policy divisions, which include the Adult Mental Health Policy Division, the Children's Mental Health Policy Division, the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Policy Division, as well as all of state-operated services. State-operated services consists of a number of different types of service centers, and I just want to briefly outline that since my arrival, I've been aggressively trying to carry forward the beginning of a transformation within state-operated services from the historical destination center institutionalized level of care from many years ago, transforming into a specialized public health care system. We have essentially six areas of care or care centers within state-operated services. We have the child and adolescent behavioral health care services, adult mental health care services, chemical addiction and recovery care services, forensics care services, the neurocognitive care services, which includes the developmental disabilities programs as well as the traumatic brain injury programs, and we also have our dental care services. I have been summarizing our goals within our administration and also what I see as our needs for the state of Minnesota around seven primary areas of achieving excellence when it comes to our mental health and addiction care services in the state. First and foremost, you'll continue to hear me speak about our need to eradicate the stigma of mental illness. You'll hear me speak about our need to improve access to the right care at the right time for individuals with mental illness or an addiction. You'll also hear me speak quite widely about our need to arrive at quality standards of care and protocols of care across providers and across the state. Our need to integrate care between mental health and addictions as well as within health systems and as well as within multiple other areas of services such as social services, education, and housing and employment. We are not afraid of the need to address our costs and improve efficiency. I think all of us in all of healthcare are aggressively looking at that, particularly under our current economic climate. However, particularly in the area of mental health care and addiction care, I think that there's truly room to arrive at some quality measures that improve care yet reduce costs and improve efficiency. Our need as specialists is really to be involved in promoting wellness, and our need is to also reduce the severe consequences of severe illness. So overall within our administration, we're going to be working to use our current services and what we have in place and try to move into this type of transformational vision, which I'm outlining here on this slide. Essentially, the role of the state and the state system should be to integrate with community mental health and addiction care specialists and to integrate with primary care specialists in a manner that allows the state to fulfill its charge to care for those individuals with the most complex care needs. And I think that this spectrum is really important as we think about the role of state system care, such as state-operated services level of care, compared to the community providers of care and compared to primary health care. What we do know is 80% of psychotropic medications in the state of Minnesota are prescribed by primary care specialists. Our need to be really thinking about integrating across this whole spectrum is really critical. And I do think that we're starting some real progress in moving in this direction. This diagram right here just demonstrates the way of thinking about arriving at the right type of care provided at the right time. If you think about a patient's level of complexity and acuity moving across the bottom axis of this diagram and the intensity of the level of care moving up this chart, essentially, those individuals with the lowest level of complexities and the lowest acuity should be able to be managed within the primary care spectrum. As you move up on this patient acuity and complexity scale, we should be able to arrive at a much better integrated way to allow the community mental health care providers to provide care. The role of our state system really should be to provide care for those individuals with the most complex array of needs. However, this level of care diagram you can imagine ranging from inpatient care, but also demonstrating that there is the need to have an array of services at this end of the spectrum that allows us to really truly stabilize patients in the most efficient way. And this diagram just shows you a model of what we'll be talking about within state-operated services over the next several months, and that is trying to arrive at, within that more complex level of care spectrum, trying to arrive at the array of services that really provide the highest degree of care. That's a snapshot, as quickly as I can and briefly as I can present to you sort of where we're going. The overview and just revisiting what we accomplished and what you all were part of accomplishing in 2007 with the passing of the Mental Health Initiative, there are three primary areas that were accomplished in this initiative, the first being arriving at a consistent benefit set, the second being development of preferred integrative networks, and the third being infrastructure investments. The latter of those three will be summarized for you by Glenys Edwall and by Sharon Audio. I'll speak briefly about the first two. If you turn to slide number 10, the comprehensive mental health benefits set was defined that allowed MA benefits that were added to the GAMC packages of care and also to Minnesota Care. And these included adult rehabilitative mental health services, assertive community treatment or ACT team services, intensive residential treatment services, otherwise known as ERTS, intensive outpatient treatment services, crisis and stabilization services, case management and care coordination, and children's residential treatment. All of these benefits have been implemented on the phase-in schedule that was initially approved in the 2007 session. One exemption is to the approved schedule is that the coverage for case management within managed care plans is taking about 6 months longer than expected and will be implemented July of this year. The treatment and service integration aspect of the initiative that was implemented included the development of preferred integrated networks, otherwise known as PINs. There are three county health plan partnerships that were awarded after going through a competitive RFP process. Currently, these were consumer-driven RFPs that went through a pretty thorough evaluative process. That all three of these programs are currently going through contract negotiations at this point. These involve health plan and county partnership, coordination of health care and social services, particularly for individuals with serious persistent mental illness, and integration of mental health and primary physical health care for those individuals. Prior to me moving on to the brief overview that you will hear of from children's mental health and also from adult mental health, I'll just make sure that there's no specific questions to me.
Any questions from members?
I'd like to introduce Glennis Edwall, who is our director of the Children's Mental Health Division.
Commissioner, I'm sorry, I was trying to get to my agenda so that I can get your name, but I do have a question for you.
Sure.
Could you give us an idea of the number of children that are currently being served in the different categories, or maybe I should ask your staff. I want to kind of get a sense of the scope of service.
I'll let Dr. Edwall address that as far as kind of, I think she's going to have a much more updated scope than I'm going to be able to address.
Thank you. Dr. Edwall, welcome to the committee. It's a pleasure to see you again. Dr. Edwall and I worked together for many, many years, so it's good to see you.
Thank you very much. My name is Glennis Edwall, and I'm director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. And Senator Torres, right, let me begin with your question so that I don't forget it, which is that our best estimate of an unduplicated count of children who are served through county-administered services and or our Minnesota programs, our Medicaid and state-funded programs, the unduplicated count is about 43,000.
Thank you, Dr. Edwall. Could you please put the microphone close to you so that we can hear you?
All right, I will do my best.
Thank you.
And I do tend to forget that, so please don't be afraid to signal me. We were extremely excited in Children's Mental Health about the passage of the Mental Health Initiative and particularly the infrastructure investments. I don't want to rehash ancient history very much, but when the Comprehensive Children's Mental Health Act was passed 20 years ago in 1989, it unfortunately was passed without the funds to really implement it. And so we have, for a very long time, tried to figure out ways in which we can make whatever investments we could along the way to try to build a system. But that system was often described as disjointed and insufficient because of that history. We still don't have adequate resources for the child and adolescent need, and I don't mean to in any way to neglect that, but we really made significant progress in 07 and are very grateful for your support. So what I want to do is just to focus on those infrastructure investments and particularly to look at the major categories of grants that we have been able to let because of that appropriation. First of all, just a few very specific goals for the child mental health system in Minnesota. These are goals that we have been working on strategically ever since an initiative in 2002 with an enormous amount of diverse stakeholder involvement that helped us pinpoint the pressing system needs that we had for children and adolescents. And they fell into these three categories. First of all, increasing early identification of mental health needs and early effective intervention. Even from parents of adolescent children now classified as having serious emotional disturbances, much of what we heard was, we could have done better for our child if only his or her needs had been identified earlier. And so we have tried to take that quite seriously. Secondly, improving access to mental health care for children and families. And third, developing consistent expectations of quality and measurement of improved outcomes for children. When we make investments, we need to know that they work and that they work very specifically in improving the outcomes for children and not just in producing more outputs or more widgets. So I want to talk about our major categories of grants very quickly. I know that my time is limited, and some of these do have some technical aspects you may have questions about, but I'll try to hit the high level. First of all, school-linked mental health services grants. School-linked mental health services grants in particular really fulfill the first two of those goals that I talked about, early intervention by picking up kids who are struggling in school and may well have a mental health diagnosis, and then improving access to care by taking services to where children are. The primary care system is a wonderful system for identifying needs in preschool children, But once children reach school age, the frequency of their visiting primary care physicians does unfortunately drop off, but school is where they are. And so we wanted to focus on school and community health provider partnerships. So we have made 21 grants to community-based children's mental health provider agencies who in turn develop partnerships with schools in their areas. I will say proactively that we certainly had a lot of varied opinions about who should be the recipients of these grants and weighed those carefully, consulted with various advocacy and parent organizations, and settled on the provider agencies as those who had the greatest capacity to make sure they were capturing third-party reimbursement as well as using our grant funds to serve other populations. The services need to be either school-located, co-located, or school-linked, which might mean identification through the schools, but then home and community-delivered services. The grantees had to show us evidence of interagency coordination, either through endorsement by their local Children's Mental Health Collaborative or through significant partner agencies, including schools and counties. And they were designed to serve children birth to 21 with mental health diagnoses. Most of them have a more restrained age, constrained age range that they've identified, but they do cover the whole gamut as a group of grantees. The grant funds themselves cover clinical mental health services for uninsured and underinsured children. The providers themselves must have the capacity to claim medical assistance and other third-party reimbursement and must also, over the course of their grant, demonstrate how they will expand the proportion of their costs which will be reimbursed. We have incorporated evaluation measures into each of these grants in terms of individual treatment outcomes, and they are all collecting information for us on common outcome measures, as well as demonstrating how they are enhancing service capacity in their region. And we have invested almost $8 million on a per annum basis in this program. On a second handout that I don't have incorporated into the PowerPoint, but that you have available as a map, you'll see very specifically where those dollars are going right now. And that map also helps you see that while we might make a grant to a single provider, since there are a relatively small number of these grants, that provider may well have services offered in several schools in many different counties. And that, in fact, is the norm outside the metro area. All right. Second grant category, Children's Mental Health Crisis Intervention Grants. This is also a very exciting program for us. We had the opportunity to make grants available to groups of counties and or tribes outside the metro area with the 2007 funds. And the reason we went outstate was, or to Greater Minnesota, was that we had had a smaller appropriation in 06, which by agreement between Greater Minnesota counties and the metro area was first invested in the metro counties, hoping that by building crisis services there, we could also stem some of the tide of movement of children to hospitals and residential facilities outside of the metro. And so the seven metro counties, which are collectively known for this purpose as metrics, have been previously funded. We made 12 grants under the crisis intervention program to these regions that comprised counties and or tribes working together. And the 12 grants then went to a total of 51 counties and 5 tribes. And so by adding the two together, the third bullet there is that our crisis grants now cover a total of 58 counties and 5 tribes, well distributed across the metro area. Again, there is a map of where these grants went. And just a couple of very quick comments about those, because we still are not quite statewide with this program. The two noticeable areas are the South Central Corridor, and I've noted here that we continue to work with 11 counties in South Central Minnesota, who in 07 also got an independent allocation from the legislature to develop a service system for those 11 counties working as an entity. And one of the services that they agreed that they would bring up were crisis services, and so we continue to work with them to do that. The other area that you'll see as noticeably not yet included is northeastern Minnesota. There, too, we have been having some very interesting conversations about uses of technology that might help them better to serve a very large geographic area, much of it very sparsely populated. And so I think we'll have some new things coming online, but they weren't really quite ready for this particular program. The grants pay for local infrastructure development to provide mobile crisis response. We cover some startup cost coverage until medical assistance and other third-party reimbursement capacity is established, and again also allows coverage of uninsured and underinsured children. One of the challenges that we have faced, particularly in moving outside the metropolitan area, is that our current benefit under Minnesota healthcare programs requires 24 hours a day, 7 days a week availability of mobile crisis services, which is, we keep hearing, very difficult in many very rural areas. On the adult side, after some experience with this, we did have a provision to make to waive that requirement under certain conditions, and we are looking in our budget package this year to also try to do the same thing for children. Again, we have evaluation measures of individual child and family outcomes, as well as service capacity growth, and have invested $2.8 million per annum. Third, respite care grants. Respite care is one of the most frequently requested services from families who often are trying very hard to cope on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis with the challenges created by mental illness in their child or adolescent, and for whom sometimes just brief opportunities for respite that could be planned, as well as to have that respite available in crisis situations, is critical to being able to maintain a child in home and community. So our grants pay for planned and emergency respite care, but not other clinical treatment. That needs to be accessed through other means, and also does not pay for case management or placement, because this is really to avoid the latter costs. Eligible children for these grants are those who are receiving county contracted or Rule 79 case management services, which means that they have already been deemed to meet the criteria for serious emotional disturbance. We made it very clear that the funds could not supplant a county's current investment in respite care, which, as some of you know, I'm sure varies enormously from county to county. We were trying to equalize that basis to some extent with these funds. And we also, again, have incorporated the same evaluation measures to measure child functional outcomes as a consequence of receiving respite. And a little over $1 million per year is being invested in that. Our staff, I must say, in this program were extremely creative in their negotiations to make our appropriations stretch to cover every county that applied for respite funds and met the other criteria. So I'm very happy to report that. Next category, the fourth category, Children's Mental Health Early Intervention Grants. This really goes back to the first goal that I discussed, which is to develop new capacity to provide developmentally appropriate mental health services for very young children. This is really how we can begin to get ahead of the curve, we believe, and so we're very excited about that. The request for proposals that we issued was open to a wide range of community-based providers and tribal mental health entities who either were already capable of providing and billing for mental health services or were interested in developing that capacity. So the range of agencies includes nonprofit agencies, community mental health centers, collaboratives, Head Start agencies, and local IEICs. And if you don't have an education background, that's probably a longer lecture than you want right now to explain IEICs, but that's a service delivery system for young children that we've tried to develop more connections with. The grants will provide funding for services to uninsured and underinsured children ages birth to five, and the grants provide for a combination of direct clinical services that would otherwise not be covered by insurance, and the other up to the half for capacity enhancements, including training and co-location in these various kinds of community agencies. The grantee, very much like our school-based or school-linked services, must evidence integration with existing community resources, especially now for young children, primary care, child care, Head Start, the aforementioned IEICs, and public health home visiting, so that we're getting as much capacity from those other resources as possible, too. The evaluation includes the capacity to provide assessments for young children, including the use of an alternative diagnostic scheme that we have been training on around the state called the Diagnostic Classification 0-3R, standing for revised, which on good faith, I believe, is going to be incorporated into the DSM-5 in 2011, as well as child outcome measures. For this program, our applications are currently under review, and we have received, actually, forgive my number here, 29 very geographically diverse applications that are currently under review, and the grants will be announced in March. And I could say this about every one of the programs I've talked about here, but for this one, I'm more conversant with the immediate data, but we got about 11 times as much money requested in this category as we have to give out. and that begins to tell us something of the need that's beginning to be identified. Fifth category, children's mental health evidence-based practices grants. I want to thank you. You have made my staff work harder than they ever knew possible, but I think it's really been invigorating and very, very exciting for all of them. And so we've been doing a lot of very diverse work. But in evidence-based practices, some of you have heard in previous sessions, we have been continuing to build on work that was begun in Hawaii, such that Minnesota now really has the most comprehensive and up-to-date evidence-based for children's mental health disorders of clinical interventions demonstrated to improve outcomes for children with frequently occurring mental health disorders. That database is very complete now for depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and disruptive behavior disorders, including oppositional defiant disorder and cognitive disorders. We have a training model that we have developed in conjunction with a number of partners. We originally had a grant from the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services that allowed us some early experimentation with this model, and then more recently have been working in tandem with our two SAMHSA System of Care grant sites in central Minnesota and northwest Minnesota. This is truly an initiative that has had, I would say, better cooperation and endorsement in greater Minnesota, and we're just now coming back to the metro area to try to build as much capacity here as we've been excited to have in some other parts of the state. We have had already two rounds of grant contracts with mental health agencies for training on the so-called Minnesota model, one cohort of seven agencies trained last October, and another group, a new group of seven agencies that will begin their training next month. The clinical trainees are supervisors within their agencies, which is critical to really getting this to move all the way down in an agency. And so then the supervisors are responsible in a second tier for training the staff who work for them. We are grateful that Dr. Bruce Chorpita, who has left Hawaii and is now at UCLA, is happy to come back and continue to be our trainer. And so trainees get five full days with him and then 6 to 8 months of weekly clinical consultation calls. The grants reimburse training time for clinicians, and that's really all. And so they're very bare-bones grants to make this money go as far as possible. The consultation that takes place on these weekly calls includes submission of child outcome measure scores. And I'll be very quick talking about these because we talked about them in the last two sessions, but we are continuing to develop use of the Child and Adolescent Service Intensity Instrument, abbreviated as the CASI, and the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire on all cases. And we're doing that in these evidence-based practices grants so that every clinician comes to the call, clinical consultation call then with dashboards developed for each of the cases that they are seeing, using the outcome measures and comparing them to the interventions that they have been working on under the database. So it's an exciting model, but very much in-depth. And then, as I said, a second group of supervisees will then be trained by these supervisors. We also worked to develop an additional RFP to expand training that had begun by Minnesota's Child Traumatic Response System, which is housed at the University of Minnesota, on a particular evidence-based practice that they were working on, which was also represented in our evidence base that we had been working on with Hawaii. And this was trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. And so we have also trained eight agencies on this particular approach to working with children who have experienced trauma. We do the very same training model that we have for the rest of our evidence-based practice database. We've gone through one cohort, and we will be starting another in June 2009. And I'm really excited to tell you that this was $750,000 to do all of this under the evidence-based practice category. Then, culturally specific capacity grants. This is also a small but very exciting program that has come out of the infrastructure investments. We have been able to make seven grants to community-based providers, tribes, and independent mental health professionals to provide treatment to cultural and ethnic minority communities. And these were already mental health providers, but to expand their capacity to do that treatment. And also to support graduates of professional training programs who are seeking licensure and to develop the skills of mental health practitioners and mental health behavioral aides who might be interested in pursuing opportunities to become mental health professionals. I didn't give you a map of these because six of the seven are in the metro area, and I didn't want to waste a tree to show you a map of the metro area. Our seventh grantee outside the metro area, though, was the White Earth Band, and we're very excited about what they are able to do. The grants in this category pay for mental health treatment services, again, for unreimbursable services, training costs for professionals, practitioners, and mental health behavioral aides who both come from and serve diverse communities, clinical supervision for culturally diverse professional licensure candidates, and work with these grantees to specifically enhance their capacity to do third-party billing. Again, we could have easily funded many times more grantees under this program than we were able to, but with $300,000, I'm really happy with the diverse communities that we're able to help support with this money. And that concludes the infrastructure investments for children's mental health, my contact information, and I'm happy to quickly take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Edwell. Any questions? Senator Hahn.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And can you talk a little bit about the progress that these programs, I mean, are we seeing fewer cases or are the conditions improving? Or just curious, I mean, you've described a lot of programs that we're funding and grants and so forth, which is great, but going back to Dr. Sulik's presentation and the goals, he talks about reducing cost and promoting wellness and those dimensions. Are these things working and are they having less cases, less severe cases? Just can you tell us how that's going?
Dr. Edward. Yes. Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, much of what we are still trying to measure in these grants is clinical progress so that we do know that the things that are being provided are actually helping children to function better. That, in turn, will have an impact on the need for accessing even more intensive services. But we are not at a point with any of these infrastructure grants yet of really being able to show overall reduction in the deepest end or the most high needs end of the continuum. These are really markers along the way to make sure that we are getting moving toward that goal. It's the first time really we're looking at clinical progress and making sure that that's being guaranteed.
Any other questions? Dr. Edwell, could you give us an idea of how many proposals you got for the school linked? You granted funding for 21 grants, and then also for the crisis intervention, you had 12 grants. But give us an idea of how many proposals you got in each category.
Madam Chair, for the school-linked grants, I'm sorry, I will have to go back to staff and get that information for you. I honestly do not remember that. For the crisis grants, we worked very carefully with regions to make sure that we were getting a single grant submitted that would cover as large an area as was feasible for implementation. And that meant that we were able to fund all of the grant applications that we received minus one. We had one that really had technical difficulties we couldn't fund. The school grants were more, but I would need help getting this exact number.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay. Next, we have Sharon Audio. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Sharon Audio. I'm the Director of Adult Mental Health Services. I'm going to try to be brief and try and finish this in about 10 minutes. What you have in front of you are two handouts that I would like to have you reference. One is called the Adult Mental Health Infrastructure Investment. It's about three pages of PowerPoint. And then attached to that you have a one-page piece of a map of Minnesota that sort of looks like this, except yours is in black and white. And then the back side of that has some pictures of housing on it. I'm going to be doing a lot of reference to the award of grants to what we call the Adult Mental Health Initiatives. Those outside of the metropolitan area are voluntary regional partnerships that have been in place for about 10 years among the counties in greater Minnesota and have been very effective. Similar to what Drs. Sulik and Edwall talked about, we have three specific goals, very similar to to what we were talking about, improving access, quality, earlier intervention. I think for too long we have waited until people fail and then address their needs in the system, and we're trying to be more cognizant of people with serious mental illness, people with first episodes of mental illness, and how can we address those more effectively. I'm going to highlight, as I said, five major services that were part of the 2007 legislative adult mental health, or the mental health initiative, and they do not by any means encompass all of the work that we're doing. The first is crisis response services. You'll see listed similar services to what's provided in the children's area. I want to highlight two of these, which I think are new and fairly innovative. First is rapid access to psychiatry. What we're doing, because of the psychiatric shortage, is also covering some hours of psychiatric time. So when someone is in crisis, they're not asked to wait a significant period of time before they can be seen by a psychiatrist and have medications provided to them. And that's been very highly effective. We also have implemented a program called Healthcare Navigators. Many people who come to crisis services initially do not have any reimbursement source and have no third-party payers. And what has been very helpful is that these individuals have been able to both work with the individual client to see what kind of coverage might be available for them, as well as then access to additional services. And that's been now implemented across the state. We are funding all regions of the state, so the entire state now has crisis response services. The average grant is about $280,000 plus some one-time startup grant. And then, similar to what Dr. Edwald mentioned, we were funding the metropolitan area in 2006. We provided them with some additional funding, and they're doing partnerships between the East Metro and the West Metro counties. The second service that I want to highlight is housing with supports. We now have 34 housing with support services projects, a total of about 819 units for people who have a serious mental illness. 619 of those were available in 2008. We anticipate an additional 38 in 2009, and there's 162 that are pending. The back of your map of the Adult Mental Health Initiative has houses on it, and that's what shows you where the housing development has been projected or is in place. And these supports cover a range of services, including tenant service, coordinators, front desk. We have many people who need not intensive services but need some sort of oversight at a 24/7 basis, and it's a service that has not been covered by any other funding source. And we also are covering some rental subsidies as well. This gives you a breakdown of where the projects are across the state. There are 9 in Hennepin County, for example, so the ones in brackets indicate how many projects per county and where they're located. We're also funding 3 projects on American Indian reservations for housing development as well. This is an area that probably is the biggest challenge we're finding, both in terms of housing development, developing the right kind of housing, as well as the support services that are needed to continue and support that particular project. We're also funding what's called intensive community rehab services. What we found is that although we have about 27 assertive community treatment teams, which are very intensive teams across the state, there is a population of people who really need some intensive services but don't yet meet that level of intensity, or there is not the service capacity available. So we are developing an alternative service for that population, as well as a transition service for people who no longer need the sort of community treatment. It's a demonstration project. Currently, we're funding 4 projects, 1 in Hennepin, 1 in Carlton County. The 3 southeast counties are Olmsted, Steele, and Freeborn, and then the Stearns, Benton, Sherburn, and Wright area. We've served 203 individuals to date, and there's capacity for an additional 96. We're doing a fairly extensive evaluation of this model to see about its effectiveness and efficacy in terms of moving forward. I think it has some real positives for areas of the state that do not have the population base to support ACT. Moving along, the next broad area is evidence-based practices. We've done a lot of work in this particular area, training providers of service to be more consistent with what we are learning in terms of evidence-based practices. We know that some practices are more effective than others. We've funded about 1,000 providers of mental health and or substance abuse treatment services to receive motivational interviewing, which is really found to be a very effective modality for persons with co-occurring mental health and substance abuse. We are funding we've paid for training and implementation for illness management and recovery for 24 agencies. We have 46 in place. And this is not just training, because I think training in and of itself is not effective, but also a lot of in-depth consultation and follow-along for implementation of these services. And then lastly, we've paid for both training around rehabilitation principles and documentation for Medicaid to 187 provider agencies. We are currently funding 10 regional adult mental health initiative areas for crisis intervention training. Crisis intervention teams are really focused on law enforcement, and it's a way to help law enforcement understand how better to serve people who have a mental illness when they are in contact with them, as well as coordination with the local mental health entities, which we feel are important. We are currently on a one-time basis funding the Ramsey County Mental Health Court. This is an area that is getting a lot of national attention in terms of people who appear at court tend to be misdemeanors, but whose major issue is mental illness, and it's a way to divert people from jails and to provide the necessary mental health services. We are underway to develop the peer specialist program. Peer specialists are consumers of mental health services who are interested in becoming providers and providing services in the mental health community. And then lastly, I want to highlight an area that we are just beginning, which is called mental health first aid. And it's very comparable to the work that is done around CPR. It's really teaching the general public both how to intervene with people who have a mental illness, either in terms of family members, how to talk with people, friends, if they think they have a mental health issue, as well as it has gone to the point of also doing some work in the community around crisis services. And then I want to just highlight very quickly the web-based bed tracking system, which was also passed in 2007. This is a partnership with the Minnesota Hospital Association. All of the hospitals now with acute care psychiatric capacity have listed their beds on this web-based real-time tracking system that allows for people in emergency rooms to go on to the system and see what beds are available across the state. We have added the crisis stabilization beds currently so that not only do they have hospital bed accessibility, but also availability of crisis beds. And then we are currently in the process of adding our intensive residential treatment beds as well, so that there will be alternatives for hospitals in terms of discharge. And I think I finished in 10 minutes. Questions?
Thank you, Ms. Audio. Any questions from members? Senator Hamm?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Audio, I guess I have a similar question as I had for your Edwall. What is your recovery rate for the patients that are being served by these programs?
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, I think that similar to as Dr. Edwald mentioned, I think for crisis services, we are diverting a number of people now who would have needed hospitalization, for example, and intervening earlier. The evidence-based practice piece is really hard, I think, at this point to say how many people are quote-unquote recovered. I think that is the focus of that attention. We're seeing more people who no longer need kind of the intensive ongoing services and are able to decrease their intensity of service delivery.
Madam Chair and
Senator Hand.
So audio. So the number of people participating in these programs is going down. Is that?
Ms. Audio.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, I would not say that they're going down. I think the people who are currently being served are getting a better range of services. We're actually seeing many more people who are beginning to access mental health care across the board. I think in the past there was a lot of stigma. I think stigma is still there, but we're beginning to see really an increased demand for service, both in terms of crisis services as well as others. So I think the numbers of people who are seeking mental health services has gone up dramatically.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Salio, I get that, and that's a little bit of what I'm wrestling with here. You talk about goals to try to promote recovery, and language seems to suggest that our goal is to try to minimize or reduce the problem. But what you're describing is it's growing, and that you're talking about funding programs, but how do we determine if these programs are more effective than other things that may be done or could be done? How do we evaluate this? How do we know that the very activity of promoting these things may be encouraging participation for reasons other than illness, that there may be just a desire to participate in a program for other reasons? I'm just trying to understand how we are supposed to evaluate the proposals and the budgets that are being directed in this way if we can't look at the situation that's being addressed improving.
Ms. Audio.
Madam Chair, Senator Hamm, we have a number of outcome measures that we are beginning to look at in terms of treatment outcomes. Are people, are their symptoms improving? Are they adhering to their medication approach? Are they being able to live independently in the community? Are they looking for employment, and are they working? Is their involvement with criminal justice system decreasing? So we have that sort of data that really does support, I think, the development of some of the services that we've talked about.
Madam Chair, I guess I'd be interested in seeing that data. I guess inclination to support, which I have, would be strengthened by looking at and saying, well, what we've done has over time reduced this problem or improved it, and I'm a little confused because you're saying that actually the need is growing, and so it kind of says, well, maybe we're not making any progress here. But if you got some information that would show, sure. I think that would be helpful for the committee.
Sure. Senator Johnson and then Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This audio, the bed tracking service, would that be on www.dhs.state.m.us?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it would not be on that. The website reference is for the Mental Health Initiative that spells out in a little bit more detail what is available. The bed tracking system currently is not available to the general public. It is specifically at this point designed for hospitals and case managers. It's not set up in a way that I think would be conducive to the general population. With the availability of beds, the people still have to call the hospitals, for example. And the concern would be that if it was open to the general public, someone might then get in the car and go to a hospital and find that bed had been full, which would not be a particularly user-friendly. We have done some demonstrations on the bed tracking system, so if you would be interested, we'd be more than willing to show that to you. It's a very easy system to use, and we are finding that in some instances people are not being diverted to hospitals significant distances away, which was happening, I think, in the past.
Senator Berger.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, this is just a simple budgeteer's way of judging how we're doing. And that is that if we're reducing the number of regional treatment center beds that we're using, we're then improving the number of people who are getting appropriate community-based services. And it works as a budgeteer's rule of thumb because we don't get any federal funding to pay for our regional treatment center placements, usually. And when people are in the community in our budget, usually they are getting federal funding. And the cost per person per service is much lower. And we have seen, up until this year, a reduction in the use of our regional treatment center beds. Governor's budget this year projects an increase because of the budget cuts.
Thank you. Next in the agenda, thank you so much for the presentation. This was very helpful. We really appreciate all the information. And we are going to move on into the agenda if we don't have any more questions. Senator Marty, we're going to hear Senate File 380.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 380 is a collection of all the mental health initiatives we're trying to pull together. This bill we're not going to be voting on today. We are going to be breaking it up into 13 other bills, of which five are being heard today as well and will be acted on. But this is following up on 2007, as you recall. We made some major steps forward on mental health. We made the largest investment in mental health in our state's history. And that's an important step because the biggest problem, I think, in our system until that time was it was woefully underfunded. It's still not appropriate yet, but it's a good first step. But there is much more to do. And people with mental illness who don't receive treatment and medication and community support often end up dropping out of school and work and alienating their families. The kids are often placed in out-of-home placement, and many end up on the streets, and unfortunately, very many also end up in the criminal justice system as well. There's much more that we can and should do, and Senate File 380 is an important next step to follow up on what we did a couple years ago. The main thing I want to get across in this bill and in all the work we're doing on mental health is the fact that all of these issues are related. Various parts of the state budget are all related. If we don't ensure access to care, we're going to see more people with mental illnesses in the criminal justice system. If we don't provide stable housing and jobs, people don't succeed, they drop out. We don't make sure that children are successful in school, they'll end up in the juvenile justice system. We end up paying now or paying later, and too often we end up paying later under the current system. I'm going to just walk through the bill very quickly because, again, as I said, we're going to be looking at the bill part by part in separate bills, some of which won't be in this committee, but we think it's important to pull together all the mental health provisions at once to take a look at them. The first article looks at the criminal justice system. We want to promote a health approach instead of a criminal justice response to crises. This section has specialized police training. It funds mental health courts and encourages discharge planning to stop the revolving door between prison for and people going back again and again and people going into state hospitals because we didn't take care of their needs earlier. The second article on page 4 recognizes that youth are leaving the foster care system often with mental illness, but they need continuing support and access to health insurance. The third article on page 5, in this article, we're trying to address access to care by increasing number of culturally specific providers. We're trying to improve suicide prevention efforts. We're adding clinical licensed clinical counselors to MA-paid healthcare professionals, and allowing people to access care across county lines. We're trying to improve access to medications, treat mental illness, including 3 months of GAMC coverage after people are released from correctional facility, increase funding for the Bridges Housing Program for dual diagnosis services and evidence-based practices. We also create mental health fatality review team. Article 4, which is page 30, deals with the fact that we need to have a strong provider community, so it addresses a number of rate issues and also works at covering activities that are needed but not currently reimbursed, such as collateral contacts. Article 5 begins on page 44, and employment is clearly an evidence-based practice. It helps people recover from mental health, and so this article is simply providing support for the for extended employment support for people with serious mental illnesses. Article 6, we're trying to expand the benefit set, the model benefits that we adopted in 2007. If you recall, we extended MA benefits to people on the state health care programs. We would extend it here to state employee coverage. In Article 7 on page 46, this article deals with the education issues, recognizing children who aren't in school due to mental illness have a good excuse and should be in, and children in residential day in day treatment program need summer school sometimes to catch up with their peers to stop them from dropping out. It allows Safe Schools Govy to be used to provide crisis intervention training to school liaison officers. Right now, many of them do not have such training, and so children are often referred to juvenile detention. We don't want to have a school-to-prison pipeline. We want to help the kids get the help they need. And finally, we focus on access to insurance for college students. It's a key time for young people with mental illness and important to help them transition as they leave high school. We will be going through the bills in more detail in a few minutes, but we do have two witnesses before that. Sue Abderholden from NAMI, I want to see if you have any comments you wanted to add.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to say that this is the work of the Mental Health Legislative Network, which is comprised of 21 different mental health-related organizations, both advocates and providers, and we've worked together, you know, these many years to try to pull all this together. And I thank you for hearing the bill this morning, this afternoon.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, we have two witnesses that wanted to speak to it, Stephen Winters and Lynn Peterson. And while they're coming up, I want to stress what Sue just said. Yes, there are a number of groups who have pulled together work on this. It's very helpful to see groups that often have interrelated focus working together to pull together a comprehensive approach. And I think they've done a great job here.
Thank you.
Do you want to go first?
Sure.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Stephen Winters. And I was asked by Sue Abderholden to talk about social services and their importance to people with mental illness. And I'm a volunteer at NAMI Minnesota. So my name is Stephen Winters. I am 41. I've been diagnosed with major depression and panic disorder. These conditions have greatly impacted my life. I was first diagnosed in 1999 when I was a seminarian in the Jesuit Order of the Roman Catholic Church. My depression played a large part in my leaving the Jesuits after being in the order for 7 years. A school teacher by trade, I began teaching art at a Milwaukee grade school. My next bout with depression occurred in 2003. I had to leave my job and have been unemployed save for various volunteer positions since that time. I left Milwaukee to return to Minnesota and my family. I lived with my parents for 5 years. During that time, I began to receive Minnesota care. This helped with my medical expenses after my health insurance lapsed. I also was encouraged by my psychologist to apply for Social Security disability, of which I was awarded in 2005. I now also have Medicare. These have helped me financially, as I would not have been able to cover daily expenses and medical expenses on my own. I have worked with both psychiatrists and psychologists to help in my recovery. In 2007, I contacted ARMS after being introduced to the program through a Fairview Day Treatment program I was attending as an outpatient. I have had an ARMS worker for 2 years now. My ARMS worker has been highly supportive, both emotionally and by connecting me with various agencies that have helped in my recovery. I now have housing and live by myself with my cat in an apartment. I have volunteered at NAMI as a receptionist for a year now. This has allowed me to help other people with mental illness and their families. I'm also working with the Minnesota Job Workforce Center to gain paid employment. With the help of my family and friends and through the various social services I receive, I'm now able to live more independently, and this has helped my in my ongoing recovery. I know there are other people with mental illness that can benefit from various social services, such as ARMS. These social services for the mentally ill can be very helpful in their lives besides. When you have a mental illness, you need help from others because you're not always able to help yourself. That is where the various social programs come in. They can be temporary helps along the way to being and regaining self-sufficiency when you experience mental illness and when you experience the crippling effects of mental illness. So I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Winters. Any questions for Mr. Winters? Thank you. Senator Marty. Ms. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Lynn Peterson, and I'm here today as Alex's mom. I brought his picture. Alex joined our family by adoption in 2004. He is now 16 years old. His life began in dangerous places. During his early years, he was subjected to emotional and physical traumas by his caregivers who were compromised themselves. Although Alex was removed from that environment by child protection workers at the age of 8, he struggles with many emotional disorders that are often referred to as a severe emotional disturbance, or SED, by mental health professionals. He also has bipolar and ADHD. Alex's story is important for you to hear because there are thousands of children living in our state with mental illness. Some of these kids are like Alex. Their early years contributed to their condition. Other children living with mental illness have had loving and wonderful parents all along. Regardless of how our kids develop mental illness, they are children whose behaviors are not their fault. Children like my son display explosive behaviors that make him appear willfully disobedient, when the reality is that he is lacking coping skills and frustration tolerance. Children living with mental illness sometimes behave impulsively, display disrespect, and seem terrified or angry much of the time. Our kids need someone to commit to them. Commitment is more important than anything else, even more important than love and security. I remember one social worker telling my husband and me, "No one wants these older kids because you'll have to take them to therapy." But we were not afraid of therapy. Just as any parents who are learning that their child might be disabled, Mark and I started this journey believing that it would be a challenge. We understood there would be problems at school, hospitalizations, therapy, numerous professionals involved in our son's life, police involvement, and even court dates. We didn't expect our commitment to Alex and his brother to be easy, but we did believe that eventually that commitment would be enough. The reality is that for Alex to become a successful adult, it will take the efforts of many more people than Mark and myself. And I'll explain what I mean. Kids living with mental illness present special challenges. When I sit at a table like this and discuss these challenges, my words are almost always received with compassion and understanding. It's easy for us to feel badly for kids who have an illness that sets them apart from the other children. It's an illness that they didn't choose. And so we're all human, so we always, of course, want to be compassionate and do whatever we can to help those kids. But it is my experience that when the chairs start flying across the room, the compassion quickly changes to zero tolerance. It just doesn't matter what Alex's diagnosis is or what he endured, one principal told me. He must put it behind him and act as society expects. That's just the way it is. And the cold unfairness of that statement is what drives me to this day. If our kids' disabilities were physical and visible, would it make a difference? I don't believe anyone would take a kid in a wheelchair to the flight of stairs and say, "You'll just have to put what happened behind you and climb up these stairs because that's what society expects, disability or not." They certainly wouldn't say it without offering that kid a lot of support to get up those stairs. Just like kids with physical disabilities, our kids need a lot of support to behave as society expects. Doctors' reports use a lot of vague words to describe behaviors. Hypervigilance, hoarding, conduct disordered. What do these mean? A kid who's hypervigilant might force himself to stay awake until the sun comes up, walking through the house several times each hour to make sure the windows and doors are all locked. Kids who have been deprived of food might hide stashes throughout their house, school, and community to ensure they won't go hungry again. A conduct disorder kid might put his fist through a window in a moment of intense frustration. Our kids have big learning deficits. There isn't much time to teach them the skills they need to be successful adults and behave as society expects them to. It requires intensive service, a community investment of time, money, and other resources, and the commitment of every single adult that the kid comes into contact with. Our son presently lives in residential treatment, where skill acquisition can be focused on 24/7. When he has been at home in the past, we've utilized PCA support for him 12 hours a day, in-home family therapy, in-home intensive behavior therapy, crisis stabilization, case management through the county. Occasionally, probation and police are involved when Alex needs help being brought under control. But with these services and the commitment of the adults who deliver them, Alex has a chance to slowly acquire the skills he will need to put the past behind him and act as society expects. A friend of mine whose son also lives with mental illness has always said society is judged by the way they take care of the weakest among them. I understand that Hubert Humphrey, Harry Truman, and even Gandhi have made this statement as well. But regardless of who said it first, it's powerful and honest, and I ask you to consider it as you make decisions about what services we can afford and what services we cannot. Because whatever investment we make in these kids today will pay a return when they are successful tax-paying adults.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. I appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Mrs. Peterson?
Madam
Chair,
Senator
Marty.
With that, we will lay this bill over because we are, as I said, going to be taking it up in bits and pieces. But I think it's important to recognize we've made some steps forward. We have a long way to go. And again, the earlier we intervene, the earlier, the better the community supports are, the less serious problems we have down the road. And I think we understand that, but we have to make sure our policies reflect that as well. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Chair,
thank you.
Senator Dole. Senator Leaves, could I ask him a quick question?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Senator Dole.
That's quite short. Are you on the bills, the different bills you're going to be presenting, is it going to be a section dealing with criminal justice specifically? I noticed the ones that are listed today are not in that area.
Senator
I don't
Martin.
Know, Madam Chair, I don't know that those bills, I'm not sure if they will have to come to this committee. They will strictly be going to the other committees.
Okay.
So the only reason for presenting it is you see is a package that we want to address those issues as well. Do you have questions about a specific part?
If I could, Madam Chair, just to
Senator,
a couple of quick
Senator
ones.
Dole.
The first one was on the three-month provision, Section 18 there. Is that long enough? Seems to me that someone is diagnosed with mental illness and they're just getting released from a correctional facility. I mean, you're taking it, so it takes you a month just to figure out what's, I mean, I've never been in a correctional facility, but I would assume it takes a month at least to just kind of get your feet on the ground, and by the time you figure out you need some services, 3 months is up. And wouldn't it be better to have a 6 or month or a year-long transition period to address those issues?
Dr. Holden,
Madam
could you
Chair,
please introduce yourself?
Sue Abner Holden with NAMI Minnesota. Senator Dahl, we were just trying to get a little piece in there. Frankly, we would love it to be even longer. But we thought it would at least take 3 months to be able to process all the paperwork to get on whatever health care program it would be, JMC, Minnesota Care, if it's still around, or medical assistance. So it was at least kind of a short period of time so that you could get everything else from the jails in particular.
Okay. Madam Chair, I guess that answer my question. So this 3 months is just to get them signed up. They're automatically eligible, but then in that period you'll be getting them onto another program that would carry them forward. Madam Chair, if I might, one other question is on the competitive grant process and these crisis intervention teams. Is this more just a conceptual program at this point? I mean, I don't see any dates or, you know, who all has to be involved. Is it, you know, all law enforcement? How often do they have to go through the training? Do they have to have it done by a particular period of time? And I guess, and I see that you've got a section that deals with kind of role-playing, and I guess that would be my the area where I would like to see the most emphasis, because I know in the past we've seen a lot of issues where someone who's obviously had a mental illness that was engaged law enforcement, and usually it ends up tragically for that person with mental illness, and it seems to me there's a lack of training on the part of the law enforcement officers. How is that going to play out, or don't you know at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, actually the CIT program, Crisis Intervention Team, is out of Memphis. It's really considered the gold standard of police training. It's been around for several years. We have quite a few police officers trained in Minnesota. The Department of Human Services also sent out some grants through the 2007 initiative so that police and sheriff could get that training. So this would just be to make sure that we could continue that process, and different, you know, police departments or sheriffs could actually apply to get the grants to come in. And the CIT is really more than just, you know, doing a training. It really is involving the whole community so that the police officers know the community mental health centers, that they hear from perhaps someone from the Mental Health Association or NAMI in the community. They hear from a real person with mental illness who's been involved in the criminal justice system. So it really is about kind of a team effort, not just kind of going off and going to a training. So you pretty much really need to come to a community in order to do that. So we would absolutely be able to hit the ground running on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, on Senator Dowell's earlier point about the 3 months for JMC, I believe until 2 years ago, we had a problem with people being released from confinement without any medications or anything, and they were cut off totally. So, yeah, it's going to be a revolving door when somebody with a serious mental illness is released from confinement with no meds, no anything. You just dump them out on the street, they're going to be back again. And so we're trying to do it. I agree with you. I think your point is well taken that 3 months is not a lot. But I think they ought to have continual care. But that's the thing. The Mr. Winters, his testimony, I mean, he talked about how, yeah, after you lost this, then he qualified for this. And having people with mental illness have to be shopping for their care is not a great way to do things. So the more we can make them continuous, the better off we'll be.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Marty. Next, we have Senator Erickson Rope, Senate File 496.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. It's good to be here today. We're talking about really important issues for Minnesota and Minnesota families. I just want to start by talking a little bit about the bill has to do with suicide prevention plans. But last week, as we were visiting with Congressman Colin Peterson, who's the federal chair of the Agriculture Committee in Washington, D.C., as we were going over all sorts of agricultural issues, one of the things he brought up is that nationally they are watching a rise in dairy suicides across the country as the dairy market is being stressed. And we've all watched the headlines over the years having to do with veteran suicides increasing. And in 2007, the Army released a report that said the number of active duty soldiers who died as a result of suicide was at an all-time high. And 2008 numbers even topped that record. So I have a lot of concerns that as our country and our state and local communities and families continue to deal with the financial crisis that we're in, that some people are going to be responding to that crisis with suicidal thoughts or suicidal actions. So it's good that Minnesota has recognized suicide as a leading cause of death in the past. And in fact, 8 years ago, we began a statewide suicide prevention plan. And I'm here today to bring you a bill that supports the continuation of that suicide prevention plan through community-based programs. And although the funding has declined and gone away entirely and then been restored and is now at a renewed rate but still a reduced rate, I want to advocate for continuing to fund really critically important base-level programs like this. And then also the second purpose of this bill is to expand awareness a little bit, because we've now got more information that there's two different groups of people in Minnesota are particularly at risk right now of suicide. And of all the age groups, I was surprised to find out to hear that people in my parents' age group, age 75 to 84, have the highest suicide rate in Minnesota. And suicide is also the second leading cause of death for teenagers, or actually a little older than teenagers, but 15 to 34, it's the second leading cause of death. And over the last number of years, since 2000, the Minnesota suicide rate has increased by over 500 deaths each year from 2000. So it's a continuing problem for us, and we really need to be aware of it and keep these suicide prevention plans in place. So I have with me today Kathy Kelso, who's going to talk a little bit about the bill, and then we're going to be receiving some testimony as well in a minute. So I'll turn bill explanation over to Kathy.
Welcome to the committee.
Senator Marty, committee members, my name is Kathy Kelso. I'm with the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. Briefly, this bill just seeks to obviously add the chancellor of the Minnesota State Colleges and the president of the University of Minnesota in the group of people who will deliberate the prevention plan for suicide prevention in the state of Minnesota. And from that plan, recognize how the community-based programs that are funded with that very small amount of funding, of less than $500,000, how that grant funding would include awareness and prevention for college-age students in the state of Minnesota. We've added the phrase lifespan plan for a couple reasons. First reason being that it is a public health approach to look at an entire lifespan to include individuals and whole communities when you attend to suicide education and prevention. And because of the very high rate of suicide among elders, clearly a lifespan plan is needed for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Kelso.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just want to mention, as well as your bill being supported by the Mental Health Legislative Network, this bill is also supported by that large group of 20 or more organizations. And we have Erica Olhart here today who has agreed to give us some personal testimony.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Erica Olhart, and I'm 22 years old. And I am on leave from the University of Minnesota, and I'm currently trying my hand as a veterinary technician student at Globe University. When I was a kid, I was depressed. But then when I turned 15, everything changed and made my earlier life seem like the trip to Disney World I took when I was 8 years old. And when I was 15, I was in high school, and they sent me to the hospital. And why? Suddenly, my mood was impossible to predict. Up, down, up, down, stay awake all night, sleep all day and night. I started to hear voices. I started to see things, weird things, scary things. My life was spiraling out of control. And so I went to the hospital, and they gave me a splurge of diagnoses, including psychotic bipolar, borderline personality disorder. I was relatively lucky because I was diagnosed in high school. In high school, I had a case manager. I had people who watched me. I had teachers who knew what was going on. And then I got to college. I was lucky. I was already part of the system. But in college, you have to work to get help. You have to go to Boynton Health, let's just say, if you're at the University of Minnesota, find someone, say, I need help. But guess what? Early college age to, 20 to 25, that's when the big ones start showing up. Bipolar, schizophrenia. And when you're that depressed or you have those problems, it is very, very hard to make that special trip and say, I need help. You may not even know you need help. And so you're going to sit there in your dorm room with no help. I have been hospitalized 6 times during my life. And I've been lucky because I have people to tell me, you need to go to the hospital. But if you're not already in the system in college, you don't have that. So that's why I think it's very, very important to get some extra help for college-age students. Not only that, this is the first time you've been away from home. So unless you went to boarding school when you were a kid, this is a totally new thing. You don't have your parents. You don't know anyone. You could be in a class with 500 people. Your teachers aren't watching you. They don't even know your name. They won't even notice when you're gone. You could go missing, and no one would notice. That's why it's so important during this high-stress time and the time when these things start showing up. Senator Marty, members of the committee, I would ask you to remember these things and help the people my age, because the way things are, they don't have any help. They're alone. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ohler. Excellent job. It's very helpful to explain what happens in college age. Questions from the committee for any of the witnesses? Not. Senator Erickson-Ropes, we have not heard. I don't know that this bill needs to go to finance because it's to the extent funds are appropriated.
Right. We're just reminding members that this is an extremely important program, and you know, as we move forward with cuts, that we ask for special consideration of this program, and then also approve the extension to a lifespan focus, and then inclusion of college students on the committee.
Senator Erickson-Ropes moves Senate File 496 be recommended to pass. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Lori, Senate File 665.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we've got Senate File 665 in front of us. I've actually got an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. I'd like to move to get
Senator
it in
Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion? It's just a technical amendment.
Mr. Chair, do we have the amendment?
It's being handed out.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
I'll wait till it's handed out. So go ahead and start explaining the bill. We'll vote on it.
Yeah, with this amendment, this is part of the Youth Moving Forward set of proposals, was ready to launch last year. I carried this bill and a couple of others attempting to help youth exiting the foster care system and entering adulthood. And what this bill does is it provides for automatic enrollment in medical assistance and continuous coverage up to age 21 for these youth aging out of the foster care system. And it does that once we adopt the A1 amendment. So if everyone has that.
Senator Lori moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay. So, again, it's automatic enrollment in medical assistance and continuous coverage up to age 21 for youth aging out of the foster care system. There's about 600 youth per year who are leaving foster care and at age 18 and hoping to strike it out and make it on their own. As you can imagine, many have ongoing health and mental health needs for which they have received treatment while they were in care, but most of these youth would be eligible for our current systems, but all too often they are not able to follow through with some of the bureaucratic issues that we place in their way and do not receive this continuous treatment. I think that everyone here certainly was a child at one time and understands that oftentimes the transition from childhood into adulthood can be painful and traumatic. Mrs. Ohlert actually just described that quite well, some of the issues that we face. And many of us have our parents, too, that have seen or are about to watch our kids try to go through this transition. And, you know, most kids do have quite a bit of support through this transition. In fact, we've done some work on that, and recent studies have shown that parents typically provide actual cash help approximating about $38,000 per year for their kids between the ages of 18 all the way to 34. This is nowhere near that extent, but it is a little bit of help maintaining the essential health services that people have had while they were in foster care. Another statistic that I've always found startling is that 95% of Americans are 25 or older before they are actually able to live self-sufficiently. So this is just one piece. It is a piece that was in Marty's broader mental health initiatives. And these youth are all too often without a parent standing over their shoulder to help them with the paperwork and the forms, all too often let this really critical access to care lapse. And we'd like to take the step to make sure that we have that service available to them. And again, this would be helpful for these youth. Their foster parent, Lynn Peterson, also spoke of the need that kids have for a commitment. And this is one way that the state, who had been these youth's parent in essence, and it's one way for us to show our commitment. And we have a couple of testifiers here. David Anderson is a youth aging out, or has aged out, and would like to tell his story.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm David. I'm 22 years old. I came from an abusive and neglectful family. My mom and dad divorced when I was 2 years old. I stayed with my mom until the custody battle was finalized. I then lived with my father until his custody was taken from him due to his abusive behavior. I moved back to my mom's, where I was also neglected and abused until my mother felt she didn't have control and couldn't handle me when she had entered me into foster care at the age of 10 or 11 years old. I moved from foster home due to my own behaviors and resentment to the world, pushing everyone away because of my lack of trust and belief that anyone could actually care about me. At the age of 17, I started to catch on and matured enough to realize that I can believe in myself and let people in and trust. And because of all the things I had been taught from counseling and was told in foster homes, finally started to click. At the age of 18, I left foster care. I was not really prepared or ready for the real world. I had nowhere to go, no job, no money, no license or car. I moved in and out of friends' houses. I really was not ready, nor did I have the resources to make the step out into the world. I did not have knowledge or guidance I needed to get medical or dental assistance. I didn't really have anywhere to go to get help or anyone to turn to. I feel it would have been beneficial to have somewhere to go to ask for guidance or help. It would have been nice to be able to continue my relationship with the programs that I was previously involved with because they knew my needs and me specifically. During the last 4 years, I've grown and matured, learned to trust and let people in, as well as gaining a lot more respect for life. It has not been easy and has been much of an uphill struggle. Since then, I have succeeded in getting my license, graduating with my high school diploma. I found employment and have recently signed up for the military. I've also seen others my age struggle to find direction and advice when dealing with decisions regarding similar situations such as drug use, teen pregnancy, or just decisions in general with everyday life. During that time, I've also been seen as a role model with my involvement in a local teen center. This, by the way, was not run by any professional counseling services and couldn't really provide the services that were needed by teens and other young adults, and has since closed. Since I turned 18 and the help I was receiving was terminated, it was like having a door slammed shut and being left in the cold with nowhere to go and no one to turn to. Unlike when others at 18 leave home, they have someone to fall back on in times of need. But when kids out of foster care or such programs leave, the door is shut and there is nowhere for them to turn or no one for them to fall back on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Ms. Reagan?
My name is Mary Regan. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, and we're a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents, including private agency foster care programs. And over the last few years, we've had growing concern about kids like David who may do very well in our programs after they've received some treatment, but clearly aren't ready at 18 to be completely on their own. And as a state, we have decided that these kids can't live with their families, and we've separated them, and we really feel like we need to share in the obligation to provide further supports for them so that they can successfully transition to adulthood. Last year we came forward, as Senator Lori indicated, under the Ready to Launch umbrella, and no talk to many of you. This committee passed this same bill last year. Also, part of our initiative last year was a requirement that the courts start to analyze and look at whether kids are being prepared for adulthood as they're in the system, and that did pass the legislature last year. So now kids, each time the annual court review comes up, the judge looks at the child, looks at the foster parent, and looks at the worker and says, what are you doing to prepare this child for independence? And that's a great step forward. But just like any child at 18, they need a little bit more support on that way, and that's what we're here asking for today. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ms. Regan. Is there a question? Senator Hand.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. And Senator Lori, just your amendment to delete the application, can you just explain why you – what is the purpose of an application? I mean, why would we delete that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, this was putting it back in the shape that we had intended to introduce it in, the shape that we introduced it in last year. We picked this up through the committee process last year. We weren't terribly smitten with the idea of making the kids fill in the application. That is one of the barriers that they have found to actually gaining access. You know, I mean, kids oftentimes think that they're ready, and they're really not, and they don't follow up on everything in as timely a manner as maybe they should. Most of these kids, almost all of them, are actually eligible for our public programs, and if we can reach out and give them that little bit of extra help to just make sure that when they are ready to step forward, they have those services, those medical and mental health services available to them, it would be a great benefit in helping them through this difficult transition. Again, it's about 600 kids per year that are aging out, hitting 18, and leaving the foster system.
And Mr. Chairman and
Senator,
Senator Lori, I remember talking about this last session, and I think I can't remember where that was added to the bill. But it seems to me there are probably other people who are 18 or 19 or 20 that are not aged out foster children that apply for medical assistance, but they go through an application process. And I would imagine that many of them are accepted if they're not working or have other things that would prohibit that. And I'm just trying to understand why this would be a different case, that if the other cases require applications, mm-hmm. Why wouldn't these same individuals who come from a foster home situation also not be required to do that? And why wouldn't that be maybe a good thing to help encourage, you know, your witness testified to over the last several years in his life coming to grips with things and making decisions, and why wouldn't this be a step in that process that would be helpful rather than, I mean, I understand that these applications are not necessarily easy, but nevertheless, I think it would be a, I don't know. I'm troubled by that. And then I think the last sentence of your bill says, once certified eligible, reapplication is not required. But if no application is required in the first place, should that also not be stricken then to make it consistent with your bill as it's been amended? I'm just.
Mr. Lord, Chair, I mean, to your second point, I'd ask counsel for some help, but I do think that there are different initial application and reapplication issues, and so we do need to address them both. But again, counsel would have the definitive answer on that. To the making the distinction between these kids that have aged out of the foster care system and the general population, I mean, it really comes down to somebody turning 18 still has that guardian involved in their lives that they had before they were 18 in the general population. Somebody leaving the foster care system at age 18 no longer has anyone there to help them through any of these procedures. And, you know, as we talk about wanting to be there for people, and that was part of the discussion that we had last year. I mean, and you do bring up very legitimate points that we take very seriously. But I think stepping forward and asking for the help, if you were a little bit closer to somebody who's actually going to give you help rather than stepping forward and asking for help and needing to go through a whole bureaucratic rigmarole, I think it's not too much of a stretch to understand that when you're ready to step forward and say, "Ooh, you know what, I'm 18, maybe I'm not invincible, maybe I'm not quite as ready as I thought I was, and maybe I would like to reach back to some of that network that supported me before I made this decision to leave the foster care system." Whatever we can do to support these youths in reaching out in an effective manner, I think, is a wise policy.
Sir Hand.
Sir Marty, does council have any advice? The last sentence of the bill ending on 1.11 to 12, is that necessary if we delete the requirement for an application in the first place?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, I think it is, just because I think it specifies that you don't have to go through the renewal process, that they are going to be eligible from 18 to 21, and that there is a requirement now that they have to, even though they're certified eligible and there's no initial application, that they don't have to go through a renewal process or a yearly process to determine or redetermine application or eligibility.
I think Senator Hand might be right, though, because I don't know if, I think it would be automated. I don't know that you need the language there.
Chairman, when I first read that, I read it as that once you enter as a foster child, you're considered enrolled permanently, forever, because it says you are not.
Until your 21st birthday.
It says you must be enrolled and be certified eligible until their 21st birthday. Then it says that once you're eligible, you don't have to apply. So I kind of took that as, well, all right, so if you get in, then you're in forever and you never have to apply. But I don't know if that was the intent or not. But I'm confused by the construction after the elimination of the application piece. And maybe there needs to be some way to clarify that, because I'm not sure if I understand the meaning.
Mr. Chair, on this point here, I'd like to know, I guess, if you're in foster care, there's a foster parent, and I'm assuming, unless there's something happens before that 18th birthday, wouldn't the foster parent be the one to kind of do the application if there's one? Why would it be put on the 18-year-old to have to do that? It seems to me that's something that should be taken care of as you're approaching that 18th birthday. Is that something that happens?
Senator Marty, Senator Dahl, you know, in an ideal world, that is how it should work, is that the youth would receive some assistance. But in today's world, where that youth is deciding to leave at age 18, they're not actually mandated to leave at age 18. They could choose to stay. But when they decide to leave, very, very, very frequently, the paperwork is not completed, and they lose access to these needed physical and mental health services that they've relied on in the past to help them through. And many times they do come to realize that there was some real value to access to those services. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Lori, but foster parents, they get reimbursed or paid for some of the services. Shouldn't that be part of the requirements, is that they have to do this paperwork? And if, you know, they have this arrangement with a child prior to 18, maybe they're at 16 or 15, they have health benefits for them at that point too, I mean, and they've applied for some sort of application. I guess I'm in following what Senator Hanna is talking about. It seems that there would be paperwork already in play, and there would be a continuation of this, and that shouldn't be on the child, just because they turn 18, that there should be some responsibility, especially for the parent who's, again, being paid to provide a lot of these services, to fill, you know, complete that application.
Senator Lori, Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, again, in an ideal world, that would be wonderful. And we do try to encourage that. And, in fact, a part of the Ready to Launch initiative that we did get passed, Mary Regan talked about, was the transition planning done by all parties involved with the youth. And that is a positive step forward. But I want you to think back to, again, the foster parent, Lynn Peterson, who talked about the severe emotional needs of her adoptive child, for which she's made that commitment for. And if you've got a child that is, you're not always communicating so well with these children. You're not, as a foster parent, you're maybe not able to do everything that would be great in an ideal world to help them get ready for this transition. I mean, sometimes these kids just aren't quite ready, and they're going to need to come back. And, you know, many times they won't realize that they need to come back and get these services. But in the world of these kids, that there's been a serious attempt to find permanent homes and permanent placements, and we have not been able to, and they're aging out of the foster care system. It is for a whole host of reasons that are very complex, and oftentimes the paperwork is just not the very highest priority. And when and if they have this change of heart and realize that some of these services would help them through the next weeks, days, months, I think it is good public policy to make sure that that is there for them.
And Senator Dow, on that point, too, I think Mr. Anderson's testimony explained very well. He was in the system, and then all of a sudden he felt he was just out on his own totally. And I think the quicker somebody like that, I mean, if they continue on medical assistance, and if they're getting counseling or other help, they're in it automatically instead of being kicked off of it and then reapplying, in effect. Mm-hmm. I just think when he described his story of how difficult it was to get the help he needed, I think that that's a perfect example of why we want to put as few barriers as possible and make it automatically continued.
Well, Mr. Chair, don't we need some sort of record of the individuals that they're getting this care anyway, that we have a continuum of record keeping? And things like social security numbers and addresses, name, it can't be that much information that they need to apply. It's all information that parent should have anyway as part of the process of setting up the initial relationship. I guess I'm failing to understand why we would suddenly not have to have that. I mean, it's one thing, maybe there's a runaway situation, I guess, and they're 16 and they didn't have time to transfer something, but unless it was those extreme cases, it seemed like there'd be some paperwork already in play. But,
Mr. Chair, David Anderson would like to just talk specifically about real-world examples.
Well, kind of like what these guys are talking about, like, I feel that when it comes to the point that, like, people should be doing their paperwork and stuff like that, and, like, the foster parents should be focusing on it, like, I can come from, like, where I'm coming from, and, like, my behaviors and stuff that, like, in the foster home or whatever, and when you come into foster care, you're more dealing with your problems and you're focused on, like, certain things. And then sometimes, like, how I was in foster care is, like, I came rebellious and, like, I started doing my own thing and just making more problems and stuff like that for the people to worry about. So it kind of makes less time for them for the paperwork and for that stuff, and they're more focused on dealing with the problems that are at hand than everything else, like the paperwork.
Ms. Regan.
I think that's a very good point, David. I think the other issue is that when a child is in foster care, all of those sorts of things are handled by their social worker. They're not handled by the foster parents. So it isn't something that foster parents typically would get involved with. The case manager, the child's child protection worker, case manager would be the one to make sure that they had
all those things in place. But the reality is that when the child is leaving, it's a different process. So the responsibility ends at 18 in many cases, and then it really is up to the child to take care of things. And hopefully, with the legislation that was passed last year, there will be more involvement, more planning. Everybody will be focused more on the next step. But we just see this as one way to make sure that that barrier isn't there for those kids who don't have that support.
So, Mr. Chair, if we don't do an application and someone who's 19 out on their own now needs some care at the hospital, they just show up, and how do they know who they are and how they're registered? What happens there? I mean, I guess I'm not following why we suddenly drop the paper trail.
Senator Dow, we're not dropping the paper trail. Okay. When supposing you enter foster care at age 15, you are certified for medical assistance until you're 18. This bill would just change it to 21.
Okay.
No change other than that.
Okay. All
right. So paperwork has to be there, but the paperwork would be there. You're just extending how long it lasts by 3 years.
And if I might, just one last thing, Mr. Anderson. First of all, I'm impressed where you're at, and I think congratulations on how far you've come, especially given your journey to get here. Just curious, where, if you're in looking back now on things, is there of the things that you've been provided or been involved with, is there certain things that helped you the most, or is it mostly just your own initiative, or how would you kind of characterize as far as what's been most helpful to get you to where you are today?
Well, basically, I'd have to say that it's really the chances. Like, I've had more than my fair share of chances, and just people not giving up, really, and they see, people saw the good in me and just decided not to give up, when kept pushing me and kept giving me advice. Though I didn't take it at the time, it's helping. Like, now that I'm looking back and after 18, like when I hit 18, now everything is coming into play and I'm like there with it all now. But basically just people not giving up and giving me all the chances and still pushing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This bill needs to go to the Finance Committee.
Oh, yeah.
Senator Lori moves Senate File 665 as amended be recommended pass, re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I'm going to take my bill next because it follows up on this and it's very quick, and then Senator Lynch will take yours after that because I believe you have some other town witnesses.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senate File 666 is a continuation of, it's part of the same process that Senator Lori was just dealing with. And this says that at the time when you age out of foster care at 18, if you request it at any time after that, that the local agency would develop the plan for your vocational, educational, and so on future, and would ensure that you get the foster care housing or counseling benefits associated with that. And that is, again, to help people who are leaving foster care and not able to deal with things on their own again. Again, it's the same people who are aging out of the system. It gives them a chance to, if they're having a crisis, if they're having troubles, to come back into it. And Ms. Regan is here to speak to this one as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. As Senator Marty indicated, this is another piece of the Youth Moving Forward, Ready to Launch initiative. And really what this language is, language that has been in rule for kids who are wards of the state. So up until this point, wards of the state were the only ones who were able to ask for supports or services. And by return, we're basically talking about coming back to the youth-serving system. So the case manager that the child may have had Right now, if an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old needs support, they have to come back and try to qualify for adult services. And there are a whole different set of standards for adult services than there are for kids. And these are not truly adults in the way that they would even suggest. So we think it's more appropriate for them to have the opportunity to come back, have someone take a look at what's going on, just like our kids do when their apartment falls through, their roommate moves out, they lose their jobs. These guys need somebody to come back and say, okay, let's take a look, let's see what we can do to figure things out, and let's work together and get you back on track.
And Madam Chair, I think the ready to launch is a good phrase for it. We're trying to make sure that these kids are able to succeed as adults, and a little bit of extra push in the 18 to 21 year old age range may help their entire future and may help them be much more successful and much less in need of future services.
Questions from members? Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Marty. I'm just a little trying to understand this. It seems like what we're suggesting here is that for certain kids that have been in foster care, they really are not adults when they're 18. But by law, they are still eligible to sign contracts, join the military, vote, all kinds of other things that are adult-like, but you're suggesting they're not really adults. And I'm troubled by this distinction because if what you're saying is correct, then some of those other things maybe ought to be restricted as well. Do we really want to have people signing contracts that are not prepared to do that, or do you really want to have people who are voting or joining the military who really are not adult-like or who are... it's almost as if you're suggesting that they have some kind of disability that prevents them from making adult decisions. And I'm just, I understand the desire to try to help, but if we say adulthood is an arbitrary date and 18 isn't the right date, then maybe it should be raised. Maybe the number should be 21 or something. But I'm just not sure if I'm, there seems to be some inconsistency, I guess, in how that. Could you just try to maybe talk about that?
Senator Marty.
Senator Hand, yes, they are adults. They're young adults, and they have all the other legal rights of adults except for drinking. We do have different ages for different parts of it. But it's the fact that they're adults still suggests to me that if we can give a little more help right now so they don't feel we've just dumped them out in the cold on the street, but... take a look at what they do. Mr. Anderson earlier testified that he was, I don't know how old he said he was, when he started to realize he has to, he's had some difficulties in the past, but he's trying to put his life together. If he has three more years to do that, I think that's great. Again, I absolutely believe the more we help them at this stage, the less help they'll need later on. And but you're right, these are adults. I'm not trying to suggest they're not adults. I'm saying that that's an age where they're still very vulnerable. A lot of mental health, mental illness things show up about that time. And I just think that if we can help them continue a little bit longer, this would be a good thing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pernasala.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, Senator Han, I think there is a period of distinction. They may legally be adults for purposes of signing some documents, but 18 to 21 is really a period of transition. Yeah. They're still termed adolescents until the age of 21 under the psychological or sociological definition. And I don't think, I wouldn't throw my own child out on the street and say, okay, you're on your own now, don't come back for me, to me for any help. You know, we let go of them gradually. We help them to move on into society so that they have the strength to become strong, mature adults, and that's a major transition from adolescence to adulthood. It happens gradually, and they don't just finish high school and then they're out on their own.
Thank you,
Chair. I'll move the bill be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. All of those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll take Senator Lynch's bill next.
Bill is moved.
Patricia.
She still has a bill, too.
Yeah.
Senator Lynch, we have Senate File 503.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would first like to just thank and acknowledge my co-authors on this legislation, Senator Marty, Senator Lori, and Senator Olsen. In 2005, a mental health task force was created to establish the qualifications and standards which all mental health professionals should maintain. The Mental Health Task Force recommended that this LPCC level of licensure be included as a mental health professional, and we were successful in obtaining that licensure. We are here today seeking authority for Medicaid reimbursement. I think, by way of background, that this new license was developed largely to help address the shortage of mental health professionals across the state. Currently, LPCC licensed individuals are not eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. And I have a number of individuals with me today that are going to provide further detail on the bill and share their stories. And I'd like to begin first with Nick Reese, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Nick Reese. I'm the chair of the Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy in Minnesota that licenses alcohol and drug counselors, professional counselors, and professional clinical counselors. I'm also a professor at Wyoming State University and volunteer supervisor at Watkins Counseling Center in Minneapolis on Wednesday afternoons. As Senator Lynch pointed out, this is kind of the last piece of that 2007 initiative with that DHS task force that came out with a recommendation to the legislature entitled The Baseline of Competency, Common Licensing Standards for Mental Health Professionals. And the LPCC licensure specifically addressed all of the recommendations of that task force, including a 48 semester credit hour master's degree. 24 of those credits are specifically earmarked in clinical areas, and I've heard evidence-based practice presented today. When fully enforced, also those requirements will be part of the education. It requires 700 hours pre-degree, clinically supervised experience, 4,000 hours post-degree clinically supervised experience by licensed professionals. In 2007, there were two main parts to the bill. One was to create the licensure. The second was to incorporate it as a mental health provider under the Adult Mental Health Act and the Children's Mental Health Act of DHS. However, due to timing at that time, we went to conference committee, and I believe Senator Marty was actually the chair of that conference committee. And because of the fiscal note and the fact that the budget had already gone through, we split the bill into two parts. And the license was created in 2007, and we're here to put that last piece in, which is to allow to include licensed professional clinical counselors under the mental health and adult mental health and children's mental health act. The requirements for that LPCC license are as high or higher than any of the other master's level professionals. I say higher not to say that we're prepared a little bit differently, and that is that as a requirement of that degree, after you finish the degree, after you're actually licensed as an LPCC, you have 4 years in which you must obtain an additional 12 semester credit hours in mental health practice related topics. So after 4 years after this licensure, these people will, when fully enacted, have 60 semester credits to their master's program. So they're as high as any other state or certainly any profession within Minnesota. And again, to remind people of the task force, that task force was made up of all of the mental health professions, except psychiatry, psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, psych nurses, and counseling. I think that's all I'll be able to my.
Mr. Chair, my next testifier is Leanne Jorgensen.
Senator Marty and senators of the committee. I'm Leanne Jorgensen. I've worked as a professor for the last years at St. Cloud State University and counselor educator, as a trainer in the Children's Mental Health Network, as a drug court program evaluator. Before that, I worked 20 years as a psychologist in a rural area, and I'm very, very familiar with some of the unnecessary complications we put and the barriers we have for mental health services. I was pleased to work on the legislation in 2004 and 2005 to get licensure for professional counselors, to bring us up to standards with the rest of the United States who already had that credential available to them. And this proposed legislation, Senate File 503, will complete the intent of that legislation. Now, Minnesota is a very, very confusing place. I work in a program that has accredited counselor preparation program. We license counselors, and then we get to the Department of Health and Human Services. They're not on the provider list. And what this means is when they go to find jobs and they're hired, but it's complicated because they can only work in certain programs at certain times with certain age groups, and it just creates unnecessary kinds of complications. It makes it hard for mental health service to be available when the providers are right there. Counseling is in a unique niche that provides mental health services and training, its development, wellness, career, individual and family assessment, and mental health. Counseling programs are available in Winona, Moorhead, Bemidji, Mankato, and St. Cloud, and their graduates stay and work in these rural areas, making them useful to the programs involved. Sometimes counselors want to move to Minnesota, and I've actually had counselors call me and not move here because they can't get hired or reimbursed because they're not listed on the DHS provider list, and they'll look and see that. In our training programs, people will pull out the DHS provider program and say, see, students, you're not even recognized in the state of Minnesota. What's going on here? Recognizing counselors by the Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services would fulfill the intent of the original legislation to have the services of well-prepared mental health counselors available in a timely and appropriate level of care. So I'm asking your support of this legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Jorgens.
Mr. Chair, my final testifier today is Christy Bordson.
Oh, I have handouts.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairs and representatives, my name is Christy Bordson. I am a licensed professional clinical counselor. I come before you today to testify on behalf of my professional experience and also on behalf of thousands of Minnesotans who are seeking quality mental health care in Minnesota. I feel very frustrated that my license is not recognized by the Department of Human Services. This causes me professional difficulty, but more importantly, I am not able to serve low-income families that are on Medicaid due to the constraints of the Department of Human Services. The reason why I originally sought my master's degree is because I'm very passionate about working with inner-city youth who are high-risk, severely emotionally disturbed. And at this point in my career, I'm not able to independently serve them. I'm not the only one in this boat. There are hundreds of other counselors that are seeking to work with the same population and are not able to do it because of this difficulty. Not only that, there's many people seeking mental health services that are on 2 to 3 month wait lists because there's not enough licensed mental health providers. And this isn't just in rural areas. This is also in inner city. I work at Washburn Center for Children in Minneapolis. This is a community mental health agency that's been around for 125 years. And we have an in-home therapy program that has a 3 month wait list right now because of a shortage of licensed professional therapists. This in-home therapy program has a lot of support in the community, and we actually save the state thousands of dollars by providing this service. The program focuses on children who are 5 to 18 who are at risk of out-of-home placement. And so far, statistics show that we have successfully kept 90% of these children in their homes. This is a huge cost savings to the state of Minnesota. High-risk children who are not offered this service often end up in residential treatment, hospitalizations. Residential treatment costs the state about $8,000 a month for one child in placement. This is a cost savings to the state of more than $72,000 to $96,000 if we can keep these children in their homes. So today I ask you for support and recognition of the licensed professional clinical counselors. We are well-educated and well-experienced counselors who can provide the service to Minnesotans that is largely needed to those on Medicaid. This is going to provide more quality of care to Minnesotans, at an affordable level, and they'll be able to get it in a timely manner instead of waiting on wait lists. And it's fiscally responsible, and it's ethically necessary. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boyd. Questions from the committee? Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I have two. I was just looking at the map that we got earlier about the school-linked mental health grants, and I see that Washburn Child Guidance Center is one of those grantees. So there seems to be a big disconnect between getting the grants to do some mental health services and then here not letting all of the folks that are available to do that be licensed. Food for thought, just that. And then, Mr. Chair, the other thing I've noticed is that in the new language that we have on pages 2 and 4 and11, we have the word postmasters, as in like the people who deliver the mail type postmasters. But in the old language, we have a hyphen between post and masters to make sure that it's like after masters as opposed to postmasters. So
Senator Higgins moves to insert the hyphens.
Insert the hyphens on 2.13, 4.3, and 11.25.
I thought they were all postmasters.
Well, I did this to Senator Solon.
I didn't see this.
Postmaster?
On Senator Higgins' amendment, all those in favor
Mr.
say
Chair,
aye.
Mr. Chair, wait a minute. On that amendment, if we're fixing punctuation.
Let's finish that one, and then you can all right. add more. All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Lori.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 211, and then also, I suppose, on line 4.1, I don't know, in licensed professional clinical counseling, comma, that's a semicolon in the other. Thought,
it's
as long
a colon
as,
in the others.
A colon, I mean, rather, in the others, right. As long as we're fixing.
Mm-hmm. So you're moving to make it a colon. Okay. On that motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I'll make you all into evidence.
Senator Bretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel in a sense that you're working against the trend, and that the trend has really been to elevate providers to the doctoral level. And I fought your battle back in the 80s when and lost when they closed out licensed licensed clinical psychologists. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering how many other states license at the master's level to be able to practice independently.
I have a handout here that has links that shows all of those stats. I think it's around 40 of the 50 states are licensing LPCs at the national level. So most licensed.
Okay. And also you've mentioned that, Mr. Chair, that there are hundreds of people ready to practice, but you've said that it will have a small fiscal impact. And there are people from the department here. I'm wondering if they would like to comment on this. And I also wonder if there are people from the health plans here and wonder what the impact would be for them. And I'm not certain whether the bill mandates that you be reimbursed or if it just allows you to be reimbursed. But my sense is you already are allowed to be reimbursed. But not perhaps we could hear from the department.
Mr. Chair, just with regard to the fiscal implications, we have requested a fiscal note. We do not have that with us today, and frankly, we were thinking we would focus on the policy discussion and save that for our next move. And it might be good to have some clarification on whether or not this is being requested or being required by adding this LPCC to that list of mental health professionals. Mm-hmm. And I'll yield if you'd like to comment.
I'm not sure the question.
Mr. Chair, I really asked the department to comment.
Okay.
John Sakel can know. You can nickel hand on this. Yeah, it's fine.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Sakel from DHS.
To clarify, the question was regarding the allowed versus required.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Zakow, yes. Whether the language just allowed licensed mental health professional to be reimbursed for services or mandated that they be covered, what it would require the department to reimburse for Medicaid services, for instance. And does the department have a position on this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, the coverage that this bill would be provide would be similar to the coverage for all the other kinds of professionals. The professional would be allowed to enroll, allowed to bill, not required.
No, Mr. Chair. I know they're not required to be reimbursed. Is the department required to reimburse them and to license them, you know, to credential them for reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, sorry, I didn't follow your question there. Yes, this bill would require the department to, when someone applies to be enrolled, then if they met the criteria, which would be licensure, then they would have to be enrolled and we would have to pay them.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think the health plans may have a different, and I don't see anybody here from the health plans, but I think the health plans may have some criteria that says, you know, they've got enough providers in the area, they don't have to credential everybody, but the DHS apparently credentials anybody who meets the criteria, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, that is correct. The health plans have more ability to limit the number of providers that they include in their network. In the state fee-for-service program, we don't have that flexibility under federal law.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I am assuming there will be a fiscal impact then from passage of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Solon, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, I would just offer that I've heard from a number of individuals in this mental health profession and in related mental health professions across the state supporting this. I have not received any adverse communication from plans to this point.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Pretner-Solon.
I don't oppose. I mean, I do support the need for additional providers in mental health, especially in rural areas. I'm just saying this is a very difficult time fiscally. And it becomes very, very difficult when we have licensed marriage and family therapists, licensed psychologists, licensed independent clinical social workers, licensed behavioral therapists, and licensed mental health counselors. It's very difficult for those seeking mental health services to know who they should be seeking help from and why there is such a distinction in so many different types of providers. I think it's very confusing.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reese would like to respond to that again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pretner-Solon, I think that was to answer your immediate question, then I'd like to go back to something. The idea of the task force was to take on just those problems. The idea that there would be a standard across master's level practice in Minnesota that consumers then could know that in fact all of these different licenses have met these particular standards. It would be less important, or it would be less... it might not be as important, let's put it that way, which particular license they were seeing when they could be assured of these minimum standards of training, right? So that was the goal of the task force, and for those five professions to come together and say this is what the minimum should be, it was an answer to the initial response of other professional communities to the counseling professional community to do that. So that was the goal. Is it confusing? Sure. I mean, it is confusing. And then I'd like to go back to just one of your, to address the other part, which is when on the idea of how many people are waiting, that's the, you know, and the boards, you know, our board licenses them, and so I know about that. Those, the people that are waiting in application-wise, I don't have the number for me, I could get it for you, that are actually applying to receive this license. It's a lot stricter criteria for the license than it is for the other professional counseling license that we have. So the numbers, if you would like them, I can get them for you. There are 33 as of, I believe, 2 weeks ago. There were 33 people in that area or that were licensed as professional clinical counselors. How many applicants we actually have in there, I don't know, but I will get you that information.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
If I might continue just a little bit. I think we need providers. I would like to see a movement toward consolidating them all into one level of professional at the master's level. Although I think there is a difference between a social worker and other mental health professionals. And otherwise, I think it becomes very difficult. And I also think that the boards get diluted. I mean, they could be working together rather than as all these separate boards in regulating the practice and protecting the public, too.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Prettner-Solon. I agree with your point, and I guess I just wanted to be clear that there is no fiscal note, Senator Lynch, on the bill. But we had this last year, and was there some fiscal note prepared then, and is it the same, and could you remind us of what that was last year?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, there is not a fiscal note prepared today. I do expect that there will be one, and we will have that when we presuming that we arrive at the finance division. I have been, you know, Senator Prettner-Solon is right, it is no secret around here. This is a very challenging time for everything. But I think there's some balance here in that we've heard much testimony earlier today about our mental health goals in Minnesota and the need and the unmet need that is out there. And we wanted to come forward with another tool, another piece of that puzzle. And I, while I haven't seen the fiscal note, I think that we will be surprised at the minimal number of people that are seeking this. And it may prove to be more fruitful and more practical than one might think.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Lynch. Just, I have one other question, just out of curiosity. Licensed professional clinical counselor, what's the income, annual income of a person with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hamm, let me shuffle papers here a minute. I can speak for southeastern Minnesota, where some of the graduates of Winona State are working. I imagine that the starting salaries for community counselors who would be eligible for a license under this would be somewhere in the neighborhood of $28,000 to $35,000. It is not most of these people are in here because they want to do not exactly what they're going to make. I did go to the U.S. Department's Occupational Outlook Handbook across the United States. They list the median income, the median 50% or the middle 50% for counselors, in the $32,000 to $54,000. In outstate Minnesota, I think it's nearer the $32,000.
Thank you.
Thank you. There was one other witness who wished to testify, real briefly, like 1 minute or so. Mr. Becker Finn.
That's about time.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Torres Ray, well, he's coming up.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, I think this question may be for Mr. Ruiz. You mentioned a number in your just a minute ago about the possible number of people who may be included in this category if we adopt this language. It is my understanding that we are in need of counselors and mental health providers who are bilingual and culturally competent. Could you please tell me what would be the demographic, if you know it, of this particular group of people? If we will increase the number, would we make any difference if we add this number of people to this existing group of providers? Would that make would it make any difference in that regard, in terms of recruiting the people that are needed in the field? Because I received numerous emails from people from hospitals, clinics, all kinds of programs who are looking for counselors who speak different languages, who have specific training on cultural issues, and it seems like we have a tremendous need in the market. So will this make help us in any way? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, one of my colleagues might be much better at addressing it, so Leanne Jorgensen. The number I gave you was there are 33 listed now. Whether they have a second language or not, I will try to find that out and get that to you. 33 licensed now LPCCs.
And I'm at St. Cloud State. I would say we have a large percentage. I would say, I'm trying to count in my head, I would say 40% of our present students are non-native English speakers. Because a master's level is a mid-level licensure, it's easier to access it than PhD-level licensure. So, in fact, it does increase students. Students can access the mid-level licensure much easier than the PhD-level licensure because it's a master's degree. It's easier to access.
So is the response that you do have potentially enough providers from different cultural backgrounds that will be eligible if we adopt this language, yes or no?
It increases the chances that you have more bilingual providers because it's a mid-level licensure.
It should, but does it?
In our program, we have... I'm trying to count in my head the names. We have a third of the people are non-native speakers. They are not all... They're all Spanish-speaking, but they are non-native speakers or second language or... Native American, and I can't speak.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Rae, in speaking for Winona, Winona itself, one of the largest populations we have down there is from Southeast Asia, especially Hmong and Winona, and I believe that I'm off the top of my head, we have trained about five or six Hmong counselors. Two of them were school counselors, I believe, and three of them in community counselors. So you know, we serve the local population. We don't recruit necessarily statewide. I can try to get you again from our demographics and at the board and see if I can update that and make it more specific.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker-Finn, I'm told you had fairly brief testimony, but you want to...
Yes, I just have a short little page and a half here. Basically, I'm here on my own, and I'm here to express my support for adding the mental health professional label to the licensed professional clinical counselor license. I'm a recent graduate from University of St. Thomas here in Minneapolis. I have a master's in counseling psychology degree, and I'm currently working as a mental health caseworker at South Metro Human Services in Ramsey County. My long-term goal is to move back to my hometown of Bemidji, Minnesota, and to work as a therapist. Unfortunately, due to concerns about the viability of different therapy licenses, I've had to delay reaching that goal. I'm qualified to work towards the LPC licensure, and indeed I have begun the supervision process and application. Unfortunately, the LPCC is not eligible to be reimbursed by Medicare or medical assistance at this time, which means that other health insurance providers that utilize the same guidelines do not reimburse the LPCC. As such, I've had to return to school to become qualified to apply for the LMFT license. This move has delayed my plans by about 2 years and has increased my student load by thousands of dollars. It has also denied an underserved area another therapist. And I think given the needs of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, in the recent economic recession, I think Bemidji could use another therapist now, not in 2 years. Further is my belief that this piece of legislation will save the state some money. I currently work with many individuals that are considered seriously and persistently mentally ill. which includes bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. My number one goal as a case manager is to keep individuals from being admitted to the hospital. In a recent training at Ramsey County Crisis Services, I was informed that the average price of hospitalization for a psychotic episode was in excess of $10,000 for about an 8 or 9 day stay. And the average price for an individual as is suicidal in the same hospital is just below that $10,000 mark. Many of my clients utilize medical assistance due to the debilitating effects of their mental illness. Therefore, the state becomes responsible for paying those large hospital bills and hospital visits. I believe the best way to avoid an individual being admitted to the hospital is to take medication and to receive support in the community. Many of my clients have found it very beneficial to utilize a therapist and to receive that support. Allowing licensed professional clinical counselors to be designated as mental health professionals, I believe, will increase the availability of therapy for my clients. As such, this will result in fewer hospitalizations and less large bills from the state that end up paying. Just like, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Any discussion? If not, Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 503 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, and members, thank you.
I think we are out of time for Senator Pretner, Senator Erickson-Ropes' bill, so we will, with that, adjourn the meeting.